The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by Tim Shipman, our incoming political editor, and Isabel Harpen, the Spectator's assistant editor. Thank you both for joining me here today. Tim, let's put these elections in some context. Reform doing very well, but how significant are they going to be?
I think we overuse the word unprecedented, and I think we overuse the word historic when we're writing about British politics. And there's been a lot of crazy, big stuff happening, huge change over the last 10 years, but I think these are potentially the most significant local elections of my adult lifetime. And I think the future of British politics and what happens up to the next general election is being framed in front of our very eyes now. You look at Reform achieving breakthroughs that UKIP or the Brexit Party never managed. They are taking votes from both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, and that's the sort of the big picture issue. The two main parties are no longer totally dominant in British politics. You've got a new kid on the block that not only is a receptacle for protest votes, but he's actually taking councils. They've already got two mayoralties, they've got three councils, and the challenge for Nigel Farage is not just to say, you hate these big parties, they've let you down for decades. He now needs to be able to say in a couple of years' time, we actually fixed stuff, we did stuff, and look at Lincolnshire, look at Staffordshire, look where we've been running the show. We've filled in your potholes. We've dealt with the local issues that annoy you. And now you need to give us a chance on the national stage. And if they can pull that off, then this could be very significant indeed.
Isabel, we're going to come on to the Conservatives in a second. But first of all, Labour. What a night of drama it was. We had the Runcorn by-election, just four votes in it. I think that is the closest by-election we've had since the Great War. What does it mean for Labour? Because, yes, they held on narrowly in some places, like the North East mayoralty. But overall, it's been a pretty dire night for them, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been really difficult. I should apologise outright that I thought the sensible thing to do during this podcast was to lock my dogs in the garden and they're now crying through the cat flap. So we have a sort of tragic backdrop to everything I'm saying, rather like Labour at one of the counts that's gone on overnight. So I apologise for that. I thought it was really interesting hearing Keir Starmer's response to this morning, which was basically to say, you know, I could stand here and say that, you know, we've achieved this, that and the other, which he then obviously was saying. But actually, I get it, which is also another typical politician thing to do. He was sort of framing it as I'm the unconventional politician who says different things. He then went on to list all the things that Labour is achieving, but said, but I understand that people want us to go further and faster with the change that they voted for. But what's really fascinating about that is that the message that a lot of Labour MPs have taken from the overnight results is that what the party is ploughing ahead with, particularly cuts to the winter fuel payment, is really unpopular with voters. And so for a lot of them hearing those words, we need to go faster, they're thinking, no, you need to slow down and do something completely different, go off in a different direction. We don't like where you're taking the party at the moment. So I think Starmer tried to have an unconventional response to particularly the Runcorn result, and ended up sounding, I think, like every party leader that any of us have listened to over the past sort of two decades responding to a bad by-election result.
I mean, the boilerplate response is always to say, this proves what I've always said and we must do more of what I always said. And that's exactly what Starmer's doing. Those of you that are on social media, have a quick look at what Luke Trill of More in Common has been putting out. He's done a very interesting graph of issues that people noticed and issues that people had a positive or negative opinion of. The issue that is by far the most noticed by voters and the least popular is the winter fuel stuff. And that is really hurting Labour. And I've been talking to Labour people over the last few months who say, should we reverse it? Is it too late? And most of the sort of clever polly people, they will say, well, actually, it's never too late to reverse a mistake. And it's clearly causing them trouble. And if I was Labour, I'd be worried in those kind of northwestern seats where they've held the councils, but Reform has come into second place. And I think Reform's probably a little bit closer than either Morgan McSweeney or people like us thought they were going to be. But actually, the interesting thing is that in some of those areas, the Tory vote did not collapse. It held up OK. And if those voters next time think, oh, we'll vote tactically reformed, you know, then Labour could lose a whole swathe of seats in those areas at the next general election.
Well, I mean, we are in the era of five-party politics, as Sir John Curtis told us last week. But overall, I mean, Tim, this is a pretty bad night for the Conservatives, isn't it? I don't think even most Tories who were bracing themselves for lots of losses would have expected it to be this bad.
No, I think that's right. And I think, look, in a sense, pricing it all in, as we have done for weeks and weeks, that they're going to lose X hundreds of seats, they're going to lose a whole bunch of councils. Possible that the Tories lose control of almost all the councils they were in control of overnight. The Lib Dems were kind of predicting that in one of their briefings last week. But I think the scale of it is bigger than we thought. And because people had sort of priced in that it's really bad, and the assumption is, oh, well, no one will come for Kemi Badenoch yet. They'll wait a year till after the Welsh elections. The sheer shock of this actually means that when I sort of woke up this morning and started looking at my messages, my inbox is inundated with Conservatives saying, this isn't working, she needs to go, why should we wait a year? Why should we faff about for another year, giving Farage 12 months in which to gather more momentum? Mm. If we're going to do this now. And I got one message from someone saying, look, there's this assumption that if we change leader again, it's, you know, we'll be seen as a basket case. But changing a leader of the opposition is very different from changing a sitting prime minister, which the Conservative Party did relentlessly in the last parliament. And I think there are people that are slightly more up for that than I think even they were expecting 12 hours ago. And that, to me, is one of the interesting things that happened.
And I think one of the really striking things, of course, is that it's Robert Jenrick who's been doing the media round rather than Kemi Badenoch today. And I think that's been noticed by some people who've messaged me, you know, members, etc., who said, you know, I voted for Kemi, but, you know, it's Rob out there. And it's really much the Rob show, isn't it, Isabel?
Yeah, Robert Jenrick walking along, speaking into the camera, moving faster in many of his videos, I feel, than he did in the actual marathon. And I think we're going to see a lot more of these kind of Robert Jenrick campaign videos on social media. But yeah, fascinating that he's also the Conservative voice sort of mopping up from these election results. And just back to Tim's point about Conservatives saying, well, actually, wouldn't it be better to remove the leader now rather than, you know, in a couple of years' time when voters are paying more serious attention to us? I suppose there's also the argument of if they removed another leader, it wouldn't be a surprising new piece of information about the Conservative Party that they quite like removing leaders. So they might as well get on with it now and have the right leader as opposed to continuing in the space where they are. And I think that's the skill of Nigel Farage, actually, in his response to Reform's stunning set of results, is that he immediately said, Kemi, please stay, we want more of you. So he immediately starts punching what is already a, you know, very sore spot for the Conservative Party about their leader, focusing it in on the thing that is guaranteed to send Conservatives bananas, because they, you know, they love nothing more than talking about whether they should replace their leader, even when a leader is doing well.
And this Jenrick gambit is very interesting. I bet he volunteered for it because he wants to go out and be performatively loyal, but he also wants to go out and say, look at me, I'm the one taking the pain on a day like this. I'm acting as the leader's human shield. She would probably have wanted him to do it because she wants him to be bought in and to be forced to say, she's doing well, let's all stick together. But, you know, politics operates on many levels, and I think we can all see the different levels that Mr. Jenrick is doing by heroically going out to defend his party today. It's all about the subtext, and, you know, I don't think any of us doubts that he thinks there ought to be a change of leader sooner rather than later.
I mean, we're expecting lots more of these kind of results. Of course, you know, the main story overnight, Tim, has been about sort of reform, but of course it's going to later be about the Liberal Democrats.
Absolutely.
Some of those kind of so-called blue wall areas where they went big in 2021.
That's right. And, you know, the Libs were at pain to stress this to journalists last week.
Anyway,
the whole story for the first, up to probably quite late afternoon, is going to be about reform. Mm. But please don't forget about us, because a lot of the places where they're going to be strong, Oxfordshire, Cambridgeshire, Buckinghamshire, you know, some of the parts of the West Country, they're quite slow to count down in Devon, and they're hoping to make big, you know, advances there. And I think what it will show, I think, you know, there's some concern, I think, in both parties about this. I think the truth of it is that the Lib Dems are taking some votes from the Labour Party, but they will be taking a lot of seats from the Conservative Party. So it's a plague slightly on both their houses. And, you know, there is a question about whether Starmer and McSweeney have got it right in terms of where they're positioning this government. They've fought so hard on sort of immigration and on welfare to try and cauterise the route, you know, the leeching of votes to reform, that they've left their left flank pretty exposed. And in parts of the Bristol mayoralty and all of that, the Greens will be very strong. And in a lot of these blue wall Tory areas, the once true blue shires, the Libs are probably going to make more advances. And their strategy is very much from the period of Paddy Ashdown. Dave McCobb, who's their campaign director, is a very shrewd guy. He's a former sort of ground campaign chief. And he knows if you get councillors, you've then got foot soldiers and you can hold the terrain you've got. There were 312 Tory seats, I think, where the Libs either already hold the parliamentary constituency or have some realistic hope of taking it next time. And I think what we'll see late afternoon and into the early evening is them putting quite a lot of tanks on the Tory lawns in those places.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, the Lib Dems have not been the story of the night and they weren't expecting to be that. But their results should worry the Conservatives as much as Reform, and actually the dual challenge of Reform and the Lib Dems is the worrying thing for the Conservatives, because if you appear to be moving too close to a Reform right, more right-wing agenda, I think is fair to say, even though Reform are not right-wing on everything, particularly when it comes to, say, the welfare state. But if you do appear to be moving more in that direction, then you lose your kind of home counties, internationalist, quite upset about Trump, like to listen to the rest is politics, other podcasts are available, type people. And so, it's difficult because you are basically, and this is always the case in British politics, but more so now the electorate is so volatile. If you please one group, you're going to annoy another group. And the party is very vulnerable with both at the moment.
And I think, but doesn't that, Isabel, doesn't that emphasise the need for good leadership? Because good leadership doesn't necessarily mean positioning yourself here or there. It means telling a story, whatever it is, effectively to the country, and being highly professional at the way you conduct yourself and how you sort of get out there and get your message across. And so in a sense, the Conservatives are probably about to have another of their periodic rows about how right-wing they ought to be. Mm. But actually what they need to be doing is, who is a good performer? Who is someone with conviction, but also a sense of how to appeal to people? And various conclusions will be drawn about that.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not just, if we come back to the Robert Jenrick question, it's not just actually about the weakness of Kemi Badenoch and the relative strength, energy, whatever, of Robert Jenrick. It's also about the wider party and the front bench in particular, who are, well, they're largely invisible, aren't they? I mean, they are so low wattage that they appear to be part of Ed Miliband's energy policy. And it just sort of, and you wonder whether that's because some of them are reasonably new to such high-profile briefs, whether they don't particularly want to throw their lot in with Kemi Badenoch, whether they're in some sort of, you know, stage of political grief where they've all mentally checked out. I mean, I think the latter is probably the explanation for why we haven't seen complete chaos in the Conservative Party since last summer's election, which many of us, myself included, were expecting. You know, I thought that actually they would make the turmoil before the election look relatively sedate once they'd lost and they were out of government. But I think Badenoch was celebrating that this week, saying that one of the surprises that she's had is how united everyone's been. I'm not sure it's united over something. I think it's either sort of, you know, on their own kind of planet, or not having anything to react against because she's not setting out any policy or indeed doing much repudiation of the Conservative governments that came before. And so if you're not taking a position on anything, then people can just sort of trundle on in quite a boring fashion for quite a long time.
I mean, Pat McFadden, the Cabinet Office Minister, Labour Minister, has a great phrase for this when he refers to his own party. He talks about the unity of the graveyard, and there's an element of that about this. Mm. Some of them have checked out completely, some of them have gone to the beach. But, you know, when you're looking for someone to come and make an impact, I think Robert Jenrick is very much the best placed to step in if there is a vacancy. But you will start to hear one other word being raised. Someone who's done some focus groups this week said to me this morning, the answer is the blonde. And we all know what that means. Mr. Boris Johnson, who has spent most of last year earning $300,000 per speech, and going on holiday for a fortnight wherever he made that speech and has barely troubled the scorers, is likely to rear his head, and he'll certainly be writing his Daily Mail column about all of this evening. We'll see how loyal he is, or how many little droplets about the ball at the back of the scrum manage to find their way into print.
Well, we look forward to reading that, and also you in print at the Spectator. Tim, when do you start that with us?
I am starting mid-June, so I think my first appearance in the magazine will be the week of the 18th of June.
Well, we look forward to that. Thank
Very
you,
much
Tim.
Looking forward to it too.
And thank you as well, and thank you for watching Coffee House Shots live today.